is working, and I can check that. Okay. Should be able to hear it. I guess we're all right.
Okay, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is Jim Boning of the Center of History of Chemistry talking with Earl L. Warwick on January 16th, 1986 in Dr. Warwick's home in Midland, Michigan. Dr. Warwick, you were born on September 23rd, 1911 in Butler, Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your father, Samuel Edward Warwick, and your mother?
My dad was with the Bell Telephone Company all of his life. He had never been to college, but he'd attended a small business school in Pittsburgh. And my mother was from a farm just outside Pittsburgh. And I guess her education probably went through high school, but that's about it. And they met and married, and he moved around a great deal as a telephone man. I used to have a number, but I'm not sure of it anymore, as to how many different places we lived in about 20 years. In my early teens and all, we moved an average of once or twice in a 2 or 3 year period. So it was really, at one point I can recall, we moved without unpacking.
Do you have any siblings?
No, actually, I'm an only child.
I see. What was it like growing up under these circumstances in terms of schooling? You're moving.
Well, it was a little bit traumatic because I never was quite a member of the local group. I'd always come in late, and everybody had known everybody else for a long time, and I was the new kid on the block, so to speak. And I was redheaded, and I had a little bit of a short fuse, I guess, and so maybe I didn't get along too well either.
Were there any particular people during this time, let's say before you went to high school, that
yes,
had any influence on
I had a very interesting time in Harrisburg when we finally lived there. I was in, I guess, from about the fifth grade on up through about the ninth grade in Harrisburg. And by the time I reached the seventh grade, my dad bought me a slide rule and a set of drawing instruments. And the man who ran our drawing class in the seventh grade was quite interested in a lot of things, and he taught us to use slide rules. And he had us build a one-tube radio with a UV-199 tube, and my dad was willing to go along with that idea and even put an antenna on the roof. And we put this thing together, and it was operated with batteries, and we began to bring in stations from all over, really. It was amazing. Of course, the air wasn't as cluttered then, but we got Chicago and Pittsburgh and WGN Schenectady, and finally everybody got tired of me being the only one that could listen, so he allowed me to buy two more tubes and put in two stages of audio amplification, and we got a big paper cone speaker, and now the whole family could listen. And during that seventh and eighth grade period, I spent a lot of time with that equipment. We really enjoyed it, and it was a lot of fun in the early days.
Do you recall the name of the teacher?
No, I don't, unfortunately. He was a very strong influence in my life, though, because well, I can recall having to write an essay, I guess, on what your plans were for the future. And even that early stage, I wrote on chemical engineering.
Yeah.
And I guess had we stayed in Harrisburg, I might have gone to Penn State. However, when we finally moved to Pittsburgh, we decided on Carnegie Tech.
You went to Perry High School in Pittsburgh?
Then? In Pittsburgh, yes. By the time I got there, well, between Harrisburg, we went to Williamsport for a short time and then moved back to Pittsburgh. And much of that moving was done based on my mother's health. She was an asthmatic, and Dad had to give her shots of adrenaline every so often. It was a pretty rough time. And so we moved back to Pittsburgh in 27, And I went into the 11th grade in Pittsburgh. And again, new kid on the block and not a member of the group. So I studied, and I guess I did very well, and graduated as valedictorian. But that was almost forced on you because there wasn't anything else that I was doing. I ended up also grading papers for the chemistry professor because he found out I liked chemistry and was good at it, and I didn't have to worry about it.
Was that your first exposure to chemistry then?
Well, I'd had a chemistry set as a growing up in Harrisburg, although chemistry sets were not really very good training, even so. They introduced you to chemicals. I never did blow up the house or anything. But
what about mathematics and physics?
They went very well. I was always pretty good at math, and I took all the math that the school had, and I took all the physics they had, and when I finally went to Carnegie Tech, I took all the math they had, so I had no problem with math.
Any high school teacher that you remember that...
Not really. They were all pretty good, although we had... I do remember a Latin teacher who taught me most of the English that I really learned, because he was insistent on diagramming sentences, which I had not met up with before. And that taught me grammar relationships a lot better than almost any other situation. The math and physics teacher was good, but I certainly can't remember his name. He was also a good teacher.
Your choice of Carnegie Tech, was that just because it was located where you were?
Located, and because of our economic circumstances. We were not poor, but we certainly were middle class, and I just didn't have the option to go away to a bigger school. And Carnegie Tech was a good school, but I did it by commuting, and that meant it was a lot less expensive. During the 4 years, I drove a car and took a friend of mine from the same borough and my dad to work, and then we would be there all afternoon because we had long laboratories in the afternoon, and we'd come back through the city and pick my dad up on the way home. So we ended up having pretty good transportation during the period.
Of course, for most of that time, that was the Depression.
That's right. It was right in the Depression. It affected it because, although my father wasn't laid off or anything, one of the banks that he was involved in closed, and so some financial problems shortly around that time did rear their heads. Although tuitions in those days were ridiculously low. I think it was something like $65 a term or something like that for the whole half year or something. So it really wasn't a great expenditure.
Were you in the chemistry department or chemical engineering?
I was in chemical engineering. Now, Carnegie Tech at that time did not have what I would say a good chemical engineering department. And I recognized that by the time I graduated. In fact, during the course of my work at Carnegie Tech, I got to know Dr. Jake Warner, who at that time was not head of the department, but soon did become the head of the department. And he knew, as I did, that the chemical engineering department wasn't very good. So he encouraged me to take a master's degree and get some chemistry, really, and emphasize physical chemistry from that point on. So I stayed on for an extra year. Well, I tried to get a job, but out of our class, I think there were 17 of us in chemical engineering, and I graduated third in the whole school and second in chemical engineering. But one person out of that whole class got a job, and that was as a male secretary downtown at some magnificent sum, like $60 a month. So there were just no jobs available. And even a friend and I looked into the possibility of cleaning up oil for fleets of trucks and things, because we did know something about what you could do to oil to take out the acids and filter it and so on. We found that one fleet already was doing it, and we didn't think there was enough business in that, so we dropped that idea. So I accepted a $400 a year fellowship at Carnegie Tech and did my master's degree there for Dr. Warner. I worked with him for the year, and that was all in kinetics of solution reaction.
Let's go back for a moment to the Chem-E department. Are there any faculty there that you remember what the department was like?
It really didn't have good equipment. They had a little bit of the laboratory with pipe-fitting tools, basically, and they talked about chem engineers being pipe-fitters. Well, that was about it. We did a few experiments about fluid flow and that sort of thing, but nothing really that taught us anything. The books were about our only source of information. The man who was head of the chem engineering department, and I can't think of his name right now, but he had a lot of consulting work on oxidation of petroleum products to make other things. And he would lecture and talk and get off into discussions about when he consulted here and when he consulted there, but not teaching us any chem engineering. And his assistant, prof in the area, was a man who really had good training either. So I felt after I graduated as a chem engineer that I certainly couldn't accept a job as a chem engineer. I just wasn't trained. Now, after going back and getting a master's degree in chemistry, that was different. I felt that I had a good background because Dr. Warner was good, and the chemistry courses were fine. They were excellent. I had no problems with
them. How many chemistry courses did you take?
I took all of them they had.
I see. Any chemistry faculty that you remember?
Well, yes. Dr. Warner, Dr. Seitz, S-E-I-T-Z. Trying to think of the organic man's name, and I can't think of it right now. He was one, though, that we recognized the fact that his notes were at least 10 years old, and he was just going through the notes, really. We recognized that he wasn't as good a teacher as he ought to be. The analytical man was good, but he, again, had a business on the side. I don't know if you see the product Seabreeze. It's sort of a lotion kind of thing. But that was his product, and I guess he was making a fair amount of money off of it. But he did teach us analytical procedures, so I learned chemistry there.
You also had an assistantship, I think, when you were doing your graduate work.
Yes, as a master's degree, I taught freshman chemistry, or rather I monitored freshman chemistry labs and recitation section for that $400. And that was good experience. It wasn't anything outstanding, and I had no problem with it because I felt I had a good background in chemistry. Dr. Warner was an excellent teacher. He went on to become president of Carnegie Tech following. Well, he first became dean of the whole college and then president and following Doherty.
When you got your degree in, I think, 1934, your master's degree,
yes.
You went to Brown. What?
Well, Dr. Warner figured that he convinced me I ought to go on for a PhD, and he had a good idea. So I'm sure he made it possible for me to go to Brown, and he must have written and talked with Dr. Krause, Dr. Charles Krause at Brown. I went there and found that Dr. Krause had quite a laboratory. He had, I guess, 15 PhDs working for him, or potential PhDs, some of whom already had their PhD, but he was keeping them on in postdoc. When I went to Brown, I looked at that area, and I was pretty sure that I was committed to Krause, but I wished, I guess, I had the opportunity to work for W.A. Noyes, who was also there. He ran a very fine ship. In fact, he gave all of his people special exams before they were admitted to graduate school, one in each of the disciplines. And I recognize that he had a very fine teaching field. All of his people were doing well. Now, Krause's people were doing well, too, but Krause ran a different kind of a ship. If he got you on board, the chances of you getting out in less than 4 years were very slim. In fact, there was one chap there who was in his sixth year, I knew, so I thought, wow, he's really got his people tied down. So I worked for a year. He wanted me to lower the raise the frequency, lower the wavelength of the measurement of dielectric constant. He was doing a lot of dielectric constant measurements of ionizable materials in solution. And that was the time that the peanut tube came out, about the size of the end of my thumb. And so I did start on that, and I got an oscillator to work, and I got it beating with the local radio station and all. But where I ran into trouble was getting a precision condenser for that, because as you were at longer wavelengths, you had big, precise condensers that you could get reproducible settings on. But now the condenser that I used was a long tube with a rod in it, and I could move the rod in and out and get changes in frequency. But to get a precise condenser of that type would have taken quite a lot of machinery hours, and so I never really got a thing that worked. And interestingly enough, after I left, the man who took on the project worked on it for another year and never solved it either, and then he went on to another project. But about near the end of that year, when I was finishing at Brown, I decided I had to get out and get a job. My father had remarried, and the woman had a daughter, and she was about to go to college, so I felt that they probably needed some help. So I tried to get a job, and I wrote letters from Brown to 50 of the major chemical companies. Never got an answer from any one of them. This was 1935. And on the way home, I took a bus into Philadelphia and visited Atlantic Richfield, which was one of the companies that I had written. And I managed to try to get an interview, and the personnel man took me into a series of offices and left me sitting on a bench and said he'd be back. Pretty soon, people were starting to leave. I looked at my watch, it was 5 o'clock, and I said, where is so-and-so? And he said, oh, he left. So basically that was the kind of interviews you got in 1935. So I just went back to the bus station and got my bus back to Pittsburgh. So there were no real jobs available either, but I did make contact with Mellon Institute and Dr. W.A. Hammer, who was head of personnel at Mellon Institute at the time, and he was interested. So
the first... Have you written to Mellon as one of your letters?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't recognized that they would be a potential place, but after I got to know Dr. Hammer and the place, I found out that that was probably a better place to apply than almost any company, because at that time they had well over 400 chemists working in there on about 75 or 80 fellowships. It was at the peak, more or less, of their growth as a research institute. But a job did open up on the so-called sulfur fellowship, and they wanted a chem engineer. Well, my training in engineering wasn't all that great, but I tried for it, and I even went to the library and looked up some things and even drew up tentative plans for a pilot plant for them to handle liquid sulfur. And I didn't get the job. A friend of mine did. So I thought, oh, well. Later on, this temporary job opened up for 2 months in the summer, and I was glad to take that, working for Dr. Rob Roy McGregor. And it was for a small glass company, the Macbeth Evans Glass Company. And we melted glass in little platinum dishes in a great big glow bar furnace. And this was in the summertime, and we were on the third floor. The temperature in that room was 92 to 95 all the time, and here you were running a 3,000-degree Fahrenheit oven all the time and taking out a half a dozen of these little dishes. Well, I learned a lot about glass, and we were working on opal glass and studying a triaxial diagram as to where the best opals were and so on. When back in the fall of 36, 37, I guess it was, Corning brought Macbeth Evans Glass Company. And so now we have a new boss, and Dr. McGregor went to Corning to see what problems they might want us to work on, because we'd been in close contact with the Macbeth Evans Company, and they were interested in opal, so that's why we were doing that. But now, with the new arrangement, we didn't know what they would want. So he came back, and he had a whole bunch of glass blocks. And he said, these blocks have a coating on the outside, and they did. It looked like it was a plastic coating with some sand in it, grains of sand. And he said, the masons don't like these because when they go to put the mortar on, the coating skids right off the block, and now the masonry doesn't adhere and so on. So we tested, and sure enough, you put water on the coating and the coating just dropped off. So we thought, wow, that wouldn't be good. Well, we didn't know too much about the coating, except that it developed that the coating had been suggested by Dr. Frank Hyde of Corning. Because years before that, in the middle of the Depression, when the RCA building went up in New York City, Corning had the job of making giant blocks of glass about 30 inches by 20 inches and about a foot deep. And the window over the main door in the RCA building is a glass mural. If you go inside, you can see it. And the question was, how do you put stuff in between these blocks? Because obviously they need something. Well, Frank had suggested a vinyl acetate, vinyl chloride copolymer with monomer mixed in and then laid in there as a slab. And then as the monomer cured, there was no change in volume. The whole thing stayed that way. And that window is still there. But that was the coating that he suggested to put on glass block. Well, what he didn't recognize right away was that it doesn't adhere to glass. We didn't know much about adhesion in that day. So we went through and wrote to various paint companies and resin companies and got in as I recall it, some 96 different materials, and put them on glass and then dropped them in water, and sure enough, every last one of them floated off. We thought, God, that's awful. So friends of ours from the Union Carbide came down with a gallon of ethyl silicate. That's tetraethyl silicate. And we tried it. We partially hydrolyzed it and found that it was nice and sticky and it really stuck to glass. So we watched it. If you hydrolyzed it more or less completely and put it on glass, it was sticky for a while, and then it finally dried up to flakes and just flaked off. So we said, well, we'll only take it partway. So we only put enough water in to hydrolyze it partway, painted it on, and then painted this vinyl acetate copolymer over top and stuck it in the oven and baked it. By golly, it worked. It wouldn't come off in water. It was really tight. Well, we went through an awful lot of testing, and I made thousands of these crazy little concrete dumbbells with glass strips stuck in them, and we even pulled them apart to make the measurement. But we proved to ourselves that we could make a coating like that. We finally mixed the partially hydrolyzed ethyl silicate in with the vinyl acetate and patented that, and that was the coating that solved the problem. Put it on the block and it would adhere. They could put sand on it and the mortar would stay on, and everybody was happy. And I'd say at least 5 years after that, we went through the Port Allegheny plant of Pittsburgh Corning, which was spun off to make these glass blocks. And sure enough, they were still using that same coating. However, now, instead of putting it on from solvent, they put it on hot and still had the ethyl silicate in it. But we got finished with that project, and we're sitting around.
What year was that?
That was about the beginning of 38, about this January 1938.
So McGregor first went to Corning in 36?
36, the fall of 36. And we moved into the new Mellon Institute in 37. So this great big new laboratory, and all, we had wonderful time.
And Corning continued the fellowship.
And so we got to looking at each other and said, you know, what if you put something on there on the ethyl silicate that wouldn't hydrolyze off? So we went down to the library and looked around, and sure enough, there were a lot of papers there by Frederick Stanley Kipping in England, where he had put a lot of things on with Grignard, and they didn't hydrolyze off. Of course, he wasn't interested in that. As he said, he got a lot of uninviting glues, and he just wasn't interested in those things. So we started to make Grignards very quickly, and sure enough, we made things that wouldn't hydrolyze off. Well, that started a whole series of processes, and we worked with regular ether Grignards for a long time until we found a paper by Andrianov, a Russian, whereby he showed that you didn't need ether if you used ethyl silicate, that you could run a Grignard in ethyl silicate, and it would not only run, but it would react with the ethyl silicate. He claimed that he could only make mono materials by that method. So we started up making that kind of stuff, and we found that we made mono, di, tri, the whole bit. And we were making ethyl, butyl, amyl, and we said, well, why wouldn't we try to make methyl? And of course, it was a little difficult to get a hold of methyl because methyl bromide was a gas and so was methyl chloride. But we borrowed a small bomb from the Gulf people and transferred in some methyl bromide, and we took turns shaking this Grignard, and the darn thing warmed, so we knew it would work. So then we had a big bomb built, about a gallon, 2 gallon, I guess,